Welcome to Inspired by Kurosawa, where we're watching a Kurosawa film and then the films it inspired. Previously, we covered Rashomon and Seven Samurai. Today, we're talking about the 1958 film The Hidden Fortress, which George Lucas has acknowledged as an influence on Star Wars. I'm your host, and I'm pretty sure we're all about to die, but at least we'll die together. My co-host is Guy, who is a quiet man living in the mountains who wishes people would just leave him alone.
Yeah, that's one of the truest introductions you've ever given me, I think.
And today we're joined by a friend of the podcast, Andrew Heaton.
Hello, good to be back.
So, and you were with us earlier on our Kurosawa journey with Seven Samurai.
I was here for Seven Samurai. Yeah, I feel like I am rapidly becoming a Kurosawa expert.
And we watched about 15 films inspired by that. I think Guy was getting tired of it. This film is interesting because honestly, you know, I'm a huge fan of Kurosawa. I've watched a lot of his films. I really never hear about this film. And I assumed when I'd heard that it influenced Star Wars, I assumed that The Hidden Fortress was like the Death Star, which turned out not to be true.
Yeah, that's what I thought was going to be the case going in as well.
Yeah, The Hidden Fortress is more like a rebel base.
Yeah. It'd be like if Obi-Wan Kenobi and them found a really badass ship that had been cloaked or something.
Right. So, also, I kind of regret that I couldn't watch the film without Star Wars in my mind because I just, you know, for the first half at least,
sure,
I'm just constantly making the comparisons. And then it sort of starts to go further away from that story. The whole reason, in fact, we came up with this Kurosawa concept was because I had watched just the first few minutes of this film, and I was shocked because I'd heard influenced by, but you watch the first few minutes of this film, and it's like, that's R2-D2 and C-3PO. He just changed the names in the script, and these are the exact same characters.
The bickering is, I mean, they have different characters. These guys are considerably scummier than the robots.
Absolutely. What you see as you watch through the film, they're very different characters ultimately, but one is tall, one is short. The tall one, that's where I would say he's very C-3PO, right? Because he's the, like, oh, we're going to die, oh, everything. Like, his dialogue is, you could just translate directly to C-3PO, where the short guy is short, but other than that, he's not like R2-D2. At all.
Because R2-D2's cool. Like, you never know what R2-D2's saying, but you know he's saucy.
And also, he knows what's going on, right? Which this guy does not.
No, the characters did not seem to have nearly so much contrast to them as R2-D2 and C-3PO have. But I do think that the comparison is extremely apt. I mean, you watch the opening scene, and you're immediately like, this just looks like the human version of C-3PO and R2-D2 walking through the desert. It's tall guy, short guy, walking in this very stark landscape. It's a very interesting, contrasting, bleak visual image, and they're bickering. And you're like, and then it ends with a swipe. The transition's a swipe, and you're like, oh my God, that's straight up Star Wars.
Star Wars completely took that swipe from this. But also, there's a point in there where the guy, and let's see their names, but I can remember is Tahe and Matashishi. So Tahe is the C-3PO equivalent. He literally walks up a hill away from the other guy. They're splitting ways, which is exactly what they did in Star Wars, right? And but that swipe just killed me because I had no idea going in. And that's totally what Star Wars did. And also, I was really interested, and nowadays my entire life is a conversation with ChatGPT. And so I asked ChatGPT, like, how in a non-digital world do you do that kind of swipe? And it's actually very technically complicated, right? They have to composite the two things together and run a light wand and all this. I mean, it's like amazing amounts of work to get something like that to happen, where today, of course, you would just
occur to me. You're absolutely right, though, because I was just like, in Adobe Premiere, they must have used a different transition slide, and that's not how that works. Not in 1958.
So we start out with these two guys who we think of, and I cannot think of any other way than C-3PO and R2-D2. But the difference is, there's a war going on, and the idea of C-3PO or, you know, Tahe is that they would go and get rich as part of the war. But when they tried to get involved in things, they were assumed to be on the losing side, which was incorrect. They were misidentified, and they were forced to dig graves. So they've, before the movie, they've spent a whole bunch of time digging graves, and then apparently they escaped that.
Yeah, their idea was to loot the bodies of the dead on the battlefield, and they got caught at it.
And that's their general, I mean, all through the movie, like, they'll just do anything, whatever is the most despicable thing. If it makes them money, you know, they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they go up into the hills, and they encounter this wise, older general. So basically, this is old Ben Kenobi.
Who's living in exile, who's in hiding. Yeah. Yeah. And is concerned with the fate of a princess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's hiding this princess, and the princess is very strong-willed. Now, here's something. I mean, she's very strong-willed. And for a Japanese character and woman, that was, you know, I think pretty. I mean, one of the interesting things with Kurosawa is that he got really popular in the rest of the world. Japan did not like him because they didn't feel that his films represented the Japanese accurately. And eventually they had to just deal with the fact that he's incredibly popular in the rest of the world. We need to start paying attention to him. And there are a couple of films. This is one. And also he did a remake, or, you know, he did a Japanese version of Macbeth, which also had, you know, the Japanese wife. And that was extremely powerful because she was running everything behind the scenes while looking like a traditional Japanese wife, which is a really amazing character and portrayal. So, yeah, now the weird thing here, I think, when you think about this being an inspiration for Star Wars, is that what is completely missed. So we have, you know, the elder warrior in the mountains who's protecting the princess, who is hiding out in the rebel base while the people are searching for her. We have no Luke Skywalker character.
Yeah, we don't really ever get one that I can think of,
Yeah, so I think that's where it's fair to say, you know, Joseph Campbell or whatever. You know, I mean, the other thing is...
Do we have, like, a Yoda, I don't think. Do we have that? Yeah. Which is very Joseph Campbell.
But we have lightsaber duels, right? I mean, you basically have your Darth Vader character, and they have a spear duel. Right, which is totally the lightsaber duel between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader, even to the degree that the Darth Vader character... Now, he's not... Unlike in Star Wars, the Darth Vader character doesn't show up until about two-thirds of the way through the film. He's not nearly as significant as Darth Vader, but he has this fight with Obi-Wan Kenobi, or with, you know...
The general.
Yeah.
Well, they have the fight... And it ends up quite differently than, you know, if you're taking these guys as Obi-Wan and Darth Vader. I mean, this fight turns out considerably differently than what we see in Star Wars. And I think that's what threw me off, because I was kind of looking for it, because you had let me know in the past that this movie was supposed to be a big influence on Star Wars. So I was looking for direct parallels, and the parallels mostly aren't direct. You know, the bickering between the two guys, you know, that's pretty much on point, I guess, but most of it is more like Lucas took this aspect of it and put it in sort of a different story, you know. So it wasn't outright plagiarism. It was more being inspired by things. Right.
So, yeah, well, for example, there's nothing in here like the, you know, the space fights, right, with the X-Wings and all that, where he very directly took World War II movies as the inspiration for that, to the degree that in the first cut, literally, he just put in World War II movie dogfights instead of X-Wings, right?
Yeah.
Although, to George Lucas's credit, though, like, I want to, like, head off any claims of plagiarism. So far as I know, George Lucas has always been very upfront about being inspired by Kurosawa, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, if you're saying, like, I mean, like, there's a lot of, like, The Lion King is Hamlet. It's just Hamlet with lions. Mm. Like, that's it, which is fine. It is Disney saying, this is an immortal classic that we think is a wonderful archetypical tale that we are going to put in this interesting way to reimagine this same phenomenon. I think as long as mm-hmm. you are acknowledging the creative debt that you have to somebody, that's all right. It's another thing if you take a bunch of stuff and you're lifting dialogue and you're not using it. So I think he was inspired by it. And is it Ron? I don't want to step on any toes. Can I point out some of the parallels that I saw in it? Because I see a bunch of stuff in there that goes through the whole thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. But one thing I'll mention is that Lucas and Coppola funded one of the last films that Kurosawa did because they felt a debt to him. So, absolutely, they never pretended they weren't influenced by him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a very nice move, by the way, to fund somebody's film like that. I'm sure that at some point they were like, by the way, we really enjoyed your film. It actually made something of an impact on Star Wars. I would be very surprised if that did not come up in conversation when they were giving him a big, giant check of money.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think the similarities between the two peasants in R2-D2 and C-3PO is previously discussed are spot on, and the kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi proxy. I think that this particular film stretches throughout the Lucas oeuvre. It's not just A New Hope, although that's most of it. So, like you brought up a moment ago, Ron, that the opposing general gets into this epic duel with our general. And in the latter half of the film, what do we see? We see that the general has this big-ass, gnarly scar across his face. And it looks, in the same way that when you watch these two peasants walking across a barren landscape followed by Starswipe, you're like, Star Wars in Japan. It's the same thing. You're looking, you're going, oh, God, it's Anakin. It looks like Anakin Skywalker, the aged Anakin Skywalker when the helmet's removed. And it's also at a point where that general has come to terms with the fact that his life was saved, and so he ends up making a munificent gesture, and there's a kind of redeeming quality that he goes through.
Although, an interesting thing about that, right, he's kind of bitter that his life was saved, because so what happens in this film is when, essentially, Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader have their lightsaber fight, Obi-Wan Kenobi lets him live. He wins, but he lets him live, which is actually a great insult to him, right? He should have killed him. And because he didn't kill him, his own people attacked him and created the scars on his face.
Yeah, if you're a samurai fighting an honorable opponent, for him to withhold the death blow is dishonoring you. So he was upset about that, but he did get over it. He got cheerful about it after he heard that little fire festival song. Yeah, so he did come around. In the fire festival, there's jokes we could make about that.
Cool. Kurosawa predicted the fire festival.
One of the other things is just a cool visual moment when they're having the horse chasing / sword fighting scene. It reminded me of the speeders on Endor. Return to the Jedi.
That's true. They're going through the forest, and
I have watched YouTube videos where they actually put those sequences together.
Well, and then one of the, and this is a really, really deep cut right here, but about a quarter of the way through Hidden Fortress, they become aware of Princess Yuki. The two peasants are horny and then want to turn her in and stuff. And like one of them goes into town and comes back and he's like, no, Princess Yuki's dead. They just hanged her. And you see the general's face fall and he sits down. Yeah. And we learned that it's his sister that was put in place in order to get Yuki out and that she was executed in her stead. So the original draft of A New Hope was more modeled after A Hidden Fortress than the version that we all know and love. But he took elements of that he cut out and he put them in episode one of Phantom Menace. So in episode one of Phantom Menace, there's an assassination attempt against, this is so deep and so nerdy. Everybody listening is just going to regrow their virginity here. In episode one of Phantom Menace, where Padme is, her life is under threat. She is a body double played by Keira Knightley.
Yep.
And so like she's wounded and it turns out, no, that's not really her. But like there is a fake princess that is taking the blows for the princess. So you actually have this film going to at least three different Star Wars films.
Oh, absolutely. So, but also the funny thing about that particular scene is Keira Knightley says, I failed you. And it's like, no, you did exactly what you're supposed to do, which is be the stand-in who got killed instead of the princess. You didn't fail at all.
Right? You. I don't think you quite understand the nature of your job. You did it. In many ways, I failed you.
But also, there are shots in there that are the swamp out of Empire Strikes Back. So I would also argue that's in there, too. So I agree. I mean, you know, you can take different...
Yeah.
Parts from different parts of it. But mm-hmm. I have to say, when we talk about both, you know, the weird fact that these two peasants are clearly C-3PO and R2-D2, but they're so different. Like, multiple times in the movie, they contemplate how they can rape the princess.
Yeah, that's not their high point, I'd say. That's,
Well, they're also, like, I felt like those characters are, like, if I can put in some criticism of the film... I got very, very tired of the one note sounds that the characters made. Mm. And what I mean by that is the two peasants that we're discussing only scream the entire film. They're always screaming at each other. And the Obi-Wan Kenobi character is always yell growling. He's always shout growling, always. You go do the thing. Like, he's always doing that. And it like, that to me was very grating. That they always, everyone is always speaking at a 10 in whatever their most irritating form is. So I found that very aggravating. But while watching it, I was like, okay, with R2-D2 and C-3PO, they're kind of, Lucas and Kurosawa are both doing the same thing, which is at least in that portion, they're entering us into the world through the bottom characters rather than the top characters. Right. Typically, mm-hmm. in an epic story like that, we're going to begin with the knight who's going off to fight, or the wizard, or the prince. And we're not. We're starting with the bottom of the totem pole. That's an interesting narrative inversion. But where Lucas makes them on the side of good. They are, to borrow a whole other scheme, C-3PO is lawful good, and R2-D2 is probably chaotic good, but they're both clearly good, whereas in Kurosawa, they're both scumbags. And there's like a touch of like, almost like, I hesitate to say Three Stooges, but the audience is enjoying their suffering because they're scumbags, which is not something that we do with Star Wars. We're rooting for the characters of Star Wars, whereas in this one, because we know that they're kind of bad, greedy, lowbrow people. There's a kind of like slapstick element of, ha ha, they fell down in a hole because it makes us feel like a lot of humor theory is built around superiority of like guy falls down a man cover and I am not him and I laugh because it makes me feel good in my position. And so Kurosawa was leaning into that a lot more than Lucas does.
That was, I think Mel Brooks had a quote about that where, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall down a manhole and die.
Yeah. You fall down a sewer manhole cover and die. Yeah.
One area where I feel that Lucas was underplaying the similarities, he actually said in the interview I watched, oh, it's coincidence that I had a princess. And I'm like, no, this is a very strong, well, this is exactly Princess Leia. You know, there's no coincidence here whatsoever.
that would seem, aside from his denial, that would seem to be one of the most obvious parallels, I would think.
Can we pick that apart, though? Because, like, they are both, the parallels are very clear. It is a princess whose home team has been destroyed, and she is the hope for the future. So in the case of Leia, Alderaan has been destroyed, and she is the hope of the rebellion against the Empire. In the case of Yuki, the clan has been destroyed, but whereas Leia has the plans to the Death Star, Yuki has the gold of the clan that she can use to rebuild it. Yeah. So there is this sort of like redemptive hope in both characters that's very clear. But I don't think they're the same characters in that, like, Yuki is pretending to be a deaf mute.
Yeah.
Whereas, and she is a strong-willed character, but she's not so much playing a rebel leader. Whereas, like, Leia is straight up a rebel leader. She is another general in the rebellion. She's not just like Julia Roberts, hey, mister, you can't say that to me. Like, it's not just like sassy, diffident girl next door. It's like girl with blaster shooting guys. So I do see a difference between them in terms of that level of rebelliousness and proactiveness in the cause.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is, and that comes from the different situations they're in, partly. And they do have different personalities. That Leia is more sarcastic, you know, she's quicker with a one-liner, whereas the princess is, you know, born and bred to be a princess. I think you get that impression.
It's an interesting thing they say in there, which is they say she has to be mute because you can't disguise her class, right? Which I take to mean because she won't take any shit from anyone, people are going to immediately recognize her.
Makes sense. Well,
it might be an accent thing too. I think in America, either we have a much more fluid class structure or we are very unaware of our class structure. Right. One of those two things compared to the British, for example. So like the British have layers upon layers upon layers of goddamn class structure. Like, this is like, because I spent a lot of time in Britain. Do you know what English people talk about? Who is posh? That's all they fucking talking about. That's all British people discuss is, because the goal is to be slightly more posh than you are and to downplay it. So you're constantly going, we had a party, it was kind of posh. Oh, look at her, she thinks she's posh. That's all they fucking discuss is that person is posh beyond their level. I am slightly more posh than I am, but I want you to think I'm 20% more posh than I am. But that's all they do all the goddamn time. And so I would assume, and accents go into it because like we have like 8 accents in America. The British have like 40 accents, and then you further subdivide it by class. So I'm guessing that Japan, being an island feudal culture that is also thousands of years old, that they might very well have that kind of thing where, me, I can talk as I'm talking right now. You can maybe infer that I'm from Middle America, but you can't really tell if I grew up in a trailer park and then went to college or if I, you know, went to, you don't really, but like you, I'm guessing you could probably tell with that. And I'm told by people that that learn Japanese that if you do not speak Japanese as your first language, even if you were 99.9% fluid, you can still be marked as an outsider, you know, after speaking it for 40 years. It's that complex. There's that much nuance. So I get that of like just her saying anything, like, you know, again, like I'm going to look at a map and go, oh, Berkshire. And like every British lord would be like, oh, you mean Baksha? You're like, oh, yes, I forgot. You disguised another one of your fucking words to make it sound different so that you can let everybody know you went to Oxbridge. Thank you.
Yep. Oh, geez, they're good with that. Like, you read something that looks like Cholmondeley and it's pronounced Chumley.
Yes, yes. It's Gloucester is Gloucester. And like, but whenever English people give me shit, because they do, they're like, well, actually, it's pronounced such and such. I'm like, cool, you know what? Maybe if we get conquered by France, we'll start pronouncing it that way too. But thus far, we've never been conquered by the French. So I guess we'll just pronounce it our way. But, we, you know, that sounds cool, though. Thanks for the suggestion. Man, I apparently have a lot of animosity towards the English. Thanks for bringing this out, rotted guy. I didn't realize this was a thing.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, obviously the whole point of this podcast is looking at this film in the context of Star Wars, and we don't have the advantage of being able to watch this first and then watch Star Wars because most of us have grown up with Star Wars. But let's see if we can talk about the film itself.
Sure. Only you fair.
Know. So as we say, you know, we start out with these guys who've been, you know, digging graves, and then, you know, they go into the mountains and they find their Obi-Wan Kenobi guy. But the whole thing is, it's all about gold and greed, and this is very different from Star Wars, right? I mean, there is a little bit of greed, especially with Han Solo in Star Wars, but we have this weird thing where they're making a fire and they find gold inside of some wood. And this turns out to be like a theme for the whole thing, right? That gold is being hidden inside of pieces of wood.
Yeah, like big sticks for kindling. They have hollow shutters, and they put these gold rods in them, about a, you know, foot long or 10 inches long, whatever. But yeah, it's that's a good scheme. Somebody had to probably spend a lot of time drilling to set all that up. Yeah, it would be good if you don't get spotted.
Right. So all they care about is finding this gold, and, you know, they accidentally stumble across it, and then it turns out that, well, his name is Makavi Rokurota, but I can only think of him as Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? Like, he already knows about all this. He has all the gold. They don't know that he's trying to protect the princess. They don't know anything about the princess. As we said, she's hiding in this hidden fortress, and they actually call it that. And so I actually asked ChatGPT about this, like, was there a concept of a hidden fortress? And apparently not. You know, it's just a thing in the movie. So the whole point, then, is them trying to get the princess out. Now, there's a weird thing here plot-wise that I don't understand, and the movie doesn't even try to explain it, right? Like, how is it when she has no followers, everybody's dead, but somehow she's going to rebuild the rebellion once she gets out. And at the end, and we actually have the Star Wars scene of kind of the, you know, a very cut down version of them getting their rewards at the end with the princess and all that. But it's really only the two, C-3PO, and there isn't like thousands of people like there were in Star Wars.
That they're up in the high place, and then they go down the stairs afterwards.
Right, but somehow, between them getting the princess out and then, she has rebuilt the rebellion. And I have no idea how she did that. Like, there were like three people.
I don't know if it's clear that she's rebuilt it or they're still getting under it. To me, at least, I didn't get that impression. I got the impression her future was uncertain. But, in the political terms, they had to cross through the enemy territory to get to the friendly territory. And fortunately, this friendly territory is apparently so friendly that it's going to offer them asylum and even, at least, if not help them, at least give them the opportunity to try and restore everything.
One of the things in this movie, which is, not in Star Wars at all, is that the huge value of the two peasants is they had developed a plan about how to get from one region to another, which was, instead of just directly going from that region to the other, because there'd be all these guards and everything, they realized they should go around. For some reason, that was an amazing idea. Like, our Obi-Wan Kenobi character had never thought of that, and their idea of going around the bad guys was so amazing that it was going to make everything possible.
that did occur to me that, this guy who appears to be a highly competent general, not only in martial arts, but probably if he's a general, he's got to have a little bit of chops in the strategic and tactical department, here these two peasants reveal their plan, and he's like, oh, that's great. Why didn't I think of that? requires a bit of suspension of disbelief, I guess, but I rolled with it. It was fine.
But I think that happens. I mean, it's the last episode of Star Wars. What is it? The Rise of Skywalker? Yeah. Because it has a similar thing where the rebellion yet again is being harrowed by the big bad guys. And it's down to like one ship. It's all been destroyed, but for one ship. And the attitude is very much, the rebellion's totally over unless these 60 people can reignite it, because it's like a campfire and you've only got one match. And if you have a whole galaxy of oppressed people, it doesn't even occur to them to rebel unless somebody goes, rebellion. It's like a meme. So there's this odd, it has to come from these specific people. Otherwise, it will forever be snuffed out of the galaxy.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if our heroes in this movie didn't succeed, if the princess couldn't survive in some capacity, then whatever the rebellion eventually rebuilt would be not her dynasty, but something entirely new, which might not be a bad thing. The inevitability of the bad guys taking over everything isn't completely established. There's more than one way to skin a cat. So yeah.
Well, I think you're right about that, Ron. I get real Marxist before the year 1750 when looking at history. Yeah. And because it's like, oh, no, if they lose, this other fucking inbred aristocratic parasite will squelch the peasants through compulsive force and predacious economics. And you're like, but he's our guy? No, they're all French. All of them. All of them are French for 500 years. But he lives part of the year he lives in London. And you're like, why are we rooting for this frog-eating Frenchman? That is, well, because I don't know, because his sigil has a lion on it. Like, yeah, so it does, like, at least in Star Wars, it's not, you know, it's not reestablishing a rival monarchy. It's about a republic.
Yeah.
The other thing, just in terms of this film on its own, without thinking about Star Wars, very surprising for a Kurosawa film, this is a comedy. I mean, all the way through, it's a comedy. I mean, it's just joke after joke, which is not what I would expect from this very serious director.
Yeah. Well, I think once you set it up with the initial scenes of the two guys, you know, alternately being nice and abrasive to each other, you know, you've got to kind of maintain that throughout, and that's where a lot of the humor comes from.
Yeah, I didn't look up Ed, so I forget the name, but there's a Russian character who's very similar, you know, Russian military character where, you know, he's a fool and all these stories about him, and it's sort of similar, right, where you get to laugh at the military and et cetera because of this guy.
I didn't find it that funny, but I think that that's like... I think that there, I do think humor evolves. It's possible it's cyclical, but like, if you look back at, I grew up listening to George and Gracie. Like, I got into it when I was in middle school, and it was great for a middle school student. Like, cause it's a lot of wordplay. It's a lot of like saying a thing and then the person doesn't understand what you mean. And it's comedically misinterpreted. It's a lot of comedic misinterpretation based on wordplay, which is really fun when you're 12. And then, like, you listen to it at, like, 35, and you're like, this is just, like, kind of dumb. And then you go back, and, like, when I was a kid, so I was born in the mid-80s, all of the sitcom characters, whenever a dad sitcom character wanted to watch a comedy, the go-to was the Three Stooges. So, like, if you're, watching Home Improvement or something, the dad, like, when he's like, I'm going to go home and watch, I'm going to kick back and have a beer, watch the Three Stooges. So, as a child, you're to understand that the font of all humor is the Three Stooges. This is the humor that all comedy runs down river of. And like in my 20s, I finally saw some of it. And I'm like, this is the goddamn dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like whoever made this should have been shot. Like all of the people involved in the project should have been put in prison for what they did to comedy. But I don't know how to phrase this without sounding like a dick. When the population is a little bit less sophisticated with humor, it really likes slapstick. And I've traveled like a decent amount, and like countries that have developed entertainment mediums later, like you can kind of see in their sitcoms, like they're very slapsticky, and they'll eventually get into a cool Arrested Development phase. Yeah. And I think that this was in a period of time when like slapstick was in, and like two guys that deserve bad things to happen to them falling downstairs is very funny to the general population. Sure.
And plus, I mean, these guys are just two stumble bums who are going out to rob corpses. So, I mean, they're not going to be making witty remarks about the poetry of Baudelaire or some such thing.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I guess where I come down is I really like a lot of elements of this. I mean, at a directing level, we started out with Rashomon, and there was a lot of like running through forests and everything, but it was a more kind of primitive, static approach here. And the directing in this is very fluid. I mean, these amazing scenes where, you know, they're going up a hill in the mountains and you know, these very dynamic cameras. And one of the things you have to realize is like cameras were very heavy and difficult to move at the time. So the idea of a moving camera was a challenge, the directing is just extremely good in all of that. And I just feel like as a film by someone like Kurosawa, there's a lot in here. I do think that some things are probably overly repetitive. Some of the humor with the two peasants is probably, you know, overly done. But I kind of feel, as I mentioned earlier, I never hear anyone mentioning this film compared to other Kurosawa films. And I think that there's actually a lot of really good stuff in this. And I really like the princess character. And I like the two guys, especially the fact that they're essentially our heroes, but they are just terrible, terrible people.
There is some enjoyment to be had in that now and then, you know, where you have the anti-hero type, you know, where you just, you're sort of rooting for him and sort of wishing he just got what was coming to him.
All right, so what do you think, Keaton? What's your closing remarks here?
I loved this for seeing the DNA of Star Wars. It was like jaw-dropping to watch the initial scene that is so visually similar. Yeah. I know that you're to do a little bit of spoilers for listeners of the show. I know that you guys will be covering Joseph Campbell in the near future. And so I feel like you're seeing kind of two different strains that went into this. I think Joseph Campbell that you're going to discuss is all about archetypes. And it's George Lucas really drilling down into this character represents this eternal character that we see again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
With Kurosawa, I felt like I was seeing the visual elements that went into this of I want to have two characters in a stark landscape. I want to have a high-speed chase. That's what I felt like. There are ideas and characters that he borrowed as well, but I feel like I saw an element of what went into George Lucas that I never encountered before, and I really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah.
One area where I feel Lucas is really overstepped, right, is he said in some interviews decades ago, he's like, oh, I saw a gap in the spiritual thing of America and I wanted to fill it. And it's like, no, you were trying to do a Flash Gordon movie. You couldn't get the rights to Flash Gordon. So you did Star Wars, which did have all these influences.
Is that true?
Yes, that is true.
He wanted to just make Flash Gordon, but he couldn't get the rights to Flash Gordon. Wow.
And so, yes, he was inspired by Campbell. Yes, he was inspired by Kurosawa, but ultimately he was trying to do a Flash Gordon film. He wasn't trying to heal the soul of America. That is my
to be fair, you know, I think a lot of creators are going to try and do both. You know, they want to make something that's going to be entertaining and fun, but they want to slide their own little messages in there too. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've, Ron and I on the podcast, every few episodes, it seems, we quote that the Hollywood executive who said, if you want to send a message, call Western Union. But to some extent, I think if you're the auteur, it's hard to resist putting some element of your own agenda in there. No, even if you do it as subtly as possible. So I'm not going to hold that against Lucas for saying that, he probably was trying to, and he's come up with a lot of, a lot of the spiritually oriented stuff he puts into his movies. I think is more good than harmful, you know, like Yoda is the classic example. You know, he's always kind of just maintaining his balance, whatever else is going on, you know. So anyway, enough on that. I just, you know, just leaping to Lucas's defense here. That's all.
Hats off to Lucas. I just feel like if George were here, I'd be like, George, take the win. Sometimes you want to make a good heart medication and you accidentally come up with Viagra. You were trying to make Viagra and you came up with a great heart medication. Congratulations. I don't really care what your motivation was. Your motivation did not have to be lofty in it for it to create something that was lofty. Hats off of that capacity. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't think we can beat that.